whole subject of the mind is sort of like the plays that used to circulate around here in England, where somebody was in distress, the hero or heroine of the piece was in distress, and he had the devil tempt him and an angel rescue him. These plays, if you can recall, used to be played in wagons. And the wagons had a trap door, and they had a trap in the ceiling. And the young fellow or young girl or whatever it was used to be there, being sorely distressed, and up through the floor would come the devil, you know, and he would say, and promise them this and that. And about the time he had actually bought the soul of this individual, and the audience was like to swoon with intense excitement, and they did, by the way. This was the most popular play that's ever been played. It played for centuries. You know, they talk about a 141-night run. This one played for centuries, all over England, many road shows. And about the time the devil was about to win, why, bang, down through the upper trap door would come an angel, you know? And the angel would say... and the devil would say, "Yipes, she's at the cops or something, you know?" And pull up the trap door, and bang, he'd be gone. And then the audience would cheer, and the person was saved, and everything ended happily. Quite an interesting drama. Must have been an interesting drama, because, as I said, it didn't play just once. It played all over the country. Why, no fair was a fair unless there was one of these contraptions there, fully equipped with a devil to drop down through and fully equipped with an angel to come onto the stage from above. It's an interesting thing that man would be this interested in the drama of good and evil. Very, very interesting, very significant. Because apparently, man is very thoroughly involved in this. And when one says, "The study and subject of the mind is a scientific approach which amateurs should never engage themselves in, which is far, far too complicated for anyone to have anything to do with at all. In fact, the human mind is something you mustn't trifle with. The human mind is something you must leave alone. The human mind shouldn't even be thought with." Now, it's all very well to have a scientific approach to this problem, but after we get all the way through with the science of it, we discover, horribly enough, terribly and arduously enough, that it's a study in good and evil. It's a study in survival and death. It's a study of the soul versus matter. And that's the subject matter of the human mind. It isn't the subject of the neurons and the synapses going snap. And it isn't a subject of the behavior of the individual from deep, unconscious, and barbaric motives. It isn't a subject of the sensor standing between impulse one and impulse two and deciding which. It's none of these things. It isn't a whole collection of Latin names added up into an unpronounceable incomprehensibility. That's not the study of the mind. It's a very, very simple problem. The study of good and evil, life and death, the soul and matter. And where does evil come in? Let's define evil. Evil is that item or activity antipathetic to the survival of oneself and his fellows. That's evil. What's good? Activity contributive to the better survival of oneself and one's fellows. And what's this thing called a soul? That's the livingness, the beingness of a person. That's all there is alive about him. Only let's not anchor it down with a lot of past twists of definition. Let's put it into this wise. Let's say that the soul is life, is the spirit, is the thinkingness, is the awareness, or any such term which communicates to you the meaning of life and vitality. Because it most closely approaches what man has understood to be the soul, it's a very easy thing to use this term. But because this term is misleading, in Scientology, it is called a thetan, or in English, thetan. Now, the crux of the whole problem lay in an understanding of the fact that a man was not mass. A man was not his body. A man was not a being like a wound-up doll. He was not a collection of meats and bloods which coursed and flowed. Like a little child will play with a doll, the livingness of man is the thing which makes the doll have a game. And that doll would have no game without the livingness of that child. You see that clearly? The doll would simply lie there and wouldn't even say mama. But with the child playing with the doll becomes enhanced with livingness. It seems to talk, it seems to walk, seems to want and not want. It seems to communicate and not communicate. And that is the activity of the doll. Why does it have this activity? It's because a child is playing with the doll. A child has a game there centered around the doll. And we remove the child from the room and the child is gone no more than a split second. And we have an awfully inanimate doll. It has no life. And when we speak of the livingness of man, we are perhaps in error to use this thing called a soul, because a soul is something that's supposed to take off and go to heaven. The dihedral of its wings has not been known. Its actual foot-pounds of thrust has never been studied. And its landing gear, whether retractable or fixed, has never been closely examined, but we do know that it takes off for heaven, or it takes off for another place, less desirable. A place which, strangely enough, is consistently described in the terminology and with the scenery of that which the people to whom it's being described least likes. That's an oddity. I've never quite figured out how hell got so many descriptions. But I was amongst the Eskimos once, and a tremendous tumult had occurred in a tribe a little further south. And an epidemic of murder was in progress. Men were dying under the spear and knife for no apparent reason. And these Eskimo were very sincerely dedicated, evidently, to wiping out their fellow tribesmen. And a member of the Royal Northwest Mounted by dog sled and so forth came into the area and was talking to him. And he said, "This is the strangest thing you ever wanted to hear. We've just stopped this epidemic." But apparently a missionary came in and talk to these Eskimo. And told them that hell was a place of eternal fire. And that murder was the surest way to go there. Naturally, that Eskimo, cold all winter, had a certain appeal. Now, hell, originally described in the Middle East, in other religions, by the way, than Christianity, it's an old idea, was, of course, being described in an area where it was all too often hot. So, naturally, they made hell an antipathetic area by saying it was hot. It also was given many other characteristics. But this is an interesting thing. It's a fascinating thing. It's the darndest thing you ever wanted to examine. But when you get down and study real hard with microscopes and bioscopes and other things, you discover that this soul can't go to hell. That's impossible. An impossibility. It really can't go there. Not sincerely and earnestly. For the good reason that when it clears out of a body, it's a very funny thing to giving you scientific information on the subject of soul. It's the first time this has ever happened. It's very funny. It's very funny because we've all pretended such tremendous knowingness on the subject at one time or not in one age or another, but nobody ever dug up any data about getting its length and breadth and thickness, you know? Something somebody was talking about all the time. Science couldn't measure it with a yardstick, so they said it didn't exist, and that finished the problem, you see? We couldn't measure it. We couldn't get it. I approached it in another way many years ago and tried to get its watts and voltages. And found out it didn't have any, but that I was measuring something. I just didn't say, well, dickens with that. Can't measure it with the tools here in the laboratory, so we won't pay any attention to it. It didn't seem to be a practical thing to do. We couldn't measure it volts and watts and so forth, and yet we still had something which was motivating a body which wasn't clearly understood, and if we had enormous number of explanations of how the body ran, none of which held good, then we certainly better find out what was running the body. And the net result of all that research years and years later was the measurement of the human soul with calipers and so forth. And one of the characteristics of it is that when it departs from a body, it couldn't possibly go to hell for the excellent reason that when it went into a body, it got there. So this whole idea, somebody had the wrong map. It's like something issued to you by a Spanish touring bureau. You've lost your own RAC maps of the area. And you say, well, give me a map of this area that I'm in, and they give you this thing, and it's got an awful lot of names on it, and there are an awful lot of beautiful paved four-pass highways on it, but somehow or other these things don't quite exist, you know? You feel a certain unreality about the whole thing as you're over there in a ditch mired down to your hubcaps. You say, it says there's a road here, but there just doesn't seem to be any road. And your feeling of reality about the road map would get very low. Now, that's the way it is. We had a nice map, and it said if you were evil, you went to hell. When you died, you went to hell. That isn't what happened, evidently. Anyway, here's this problem of a dead body. It's a problem. It's a problem to an awful lot of people. As a matter of fact, the police dramatize it. It's like the Royal Northwest Mounted Policeman went up and interrogated these Eskimo to find out why are all these bodies lying there with no motion in them. This is a point. Bodies with no motion in them at all. Problem. So it's always been a problem. There it is. It's dead. When you touch it, no motion at all. You pick up its leg, thud. You say, Joe, why don't you get up and continue this fencing match? And he doesn't say a word. And finally, in disgust, we pick him up and take him out and dig a hole and put him in and fill a hole in. It's one way of solving the problem. At least it won't be lying around the gymnasium tripping people. There's never any solution to this thing, though. Fellow is alive. He's dead. Well, when the machine age came along and the Swiss started building clocks, and the British started to conquer the seven seas by being able to navigate with them, they found out that when you stuck an ice pick or something into a clock, it stopped running. And they said, we've solved death. Isn't this wonderful? Now that's why Joe didn't move after I put that Raffiez through him. Now we know ice picks, chunk. We took a clock, we hit it with a hammer. Didn't run. Didn't function. We say we've got it all solved. We've had chaos ever since. But that problem's solved. Man is dead because his machinery isn't running. See? Isn't that a nice solution? We get the whole thing out of the road and we clear the deck so we can do something else, such as commit political suicide and all kinds of things. The only trouble is, but if you look at living tissue very closely, you just don't find a complete explanation of how this stuff is working. We saw the top off of a fellow's head like psychiatrists do lately, you know, and we look at it. We say, no clock. Sew it on again hastily. We meant to fix something, but there wasn't anything there to fix. Of course, they go further than that, actually. They take the top of the head off, and they stick an ice pick in, and they close the top of the head off and say, now he should be sane. Did you ever fix a clock that way? See, their theory, they've even abandoned that theory. And we take a fellow's heart, and we say, well, now you see. You see, his heart runs because of the... Well, it runs... And we say, well, the body is actually a carbon oxygen engine. I've said this myself, by the way. Shows you shouldn't put a single dependence on a single word I say, because I've said this in lectures. The body is a carbon oxygen engine running at 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Its combustion rate is so-and-so. Its bustion rate is 70 years. And that's what body is. That's all very well, but when we try to build an engine, carbon oxygen, heat engine, that runs at 98.6, it doesn't run. And this is probably just because we're bad mechanics, we say. Must be an engine. It just must be, we hope. Because if it ceases to be an engine, self-motivated, self-contained, then we have no other choice but to pick up another explanation, and we don't have one. So we'd better be stuck with this explanation of a 98.6 carbon oxygen heat engine, because when you stick an ice pick in a clock, it stops. But do you know that almost every effort to repair this 98.6 carbon oxygen heat engine fails? It does a very peculiar thing. It repairs itself. Only let's not really look at that datum. Here's a clock, you see. We stick an ice pick in it, and it stops. And we take the ice pick out, and it immediately patches up its gears and goes on running. That's a funny-sounding clock. Swiss don't make them. I know. Last one I hit with a hammer, it just stayed there. Didn't patch itself up at all. But if we stick this fellow Joe slightly, and we pull the rapier out and wipe it clean because we're neat, he lies around and says you shouldn't have done that by being pale, upset for a long time. And then he heals the whole thing up and goes out and has another duel. It's curiosity, great curiosity. What's going on here? Well, science says, well, he has a bunch of mechanics inside of him. These are called phagocytes, and they eat up all the germs, and there's hemoglobin, and there's corpuscles, and mechanics, you know? Well, I had a bunch of cells one day. I was looking at them through a microscope, so I put them on top of a busted clock. Didn't know what they were doing. Something's wrong here. Something's wrong about this whole thing. Somehow or other, a clock doesn't care whether it lives or dies. But a man does. There's a difference. And when the man doesn't care whether he lives or dies, he behaves like a clock. It's broken. He doesn't build it again. And it's only whether or not he cares whether he lives or dies. Here we have this individual, and we just stuck him slightly. Not very much, we just stuck him slightly. And he goes ahead and dies. We say, this is an imposition. What's happened here? We didn't really interfere with any of his vital machinery, but he's dead. Well, we find out his girl left him the day before. We find out that he's gone bankrupt or something of the sort. He doesn't care to live. So he died. What is this item that doesn't care to live or die? There's something new here. A clock doesn't care and a man does. And that's the entire crux of the problem. You can make a man so that he doesn't care anymore and he runs down at once or slowly over the next 20 years. We can take this man and by making him think certain thoughts, make his machine run right. We can take this man and repair his mainspring and he keeps running wrong. But we can patch up some thoughts and he runs right. So this thing is capable of thought and thinkingness. It cares whether he lives or dies. It's capable of thought and thinkingness. And further tests demonstrate that when a man's dead, the child has left the room. And that's all that's happened. Somebody didn't care to play with that doll anymore. Somebody didn't patch it up again. All the way up to that point, this somebody or this thinkingness or this somethingness which cares whether it lives or dies or whether things live or die was willing to posture and animate this doll. And then one day didn't care to anymore, and the doll has lain in the corner ever since, unmoved. And there, actually, we have the explanation. You understand that by this explanation, we do fantastic things. In a thoroughly scientific way, we simply raise a person's ability and his IQ and everything else. Nobody's ever worked with this item that way before. Nobody's ever done this sort of thing before. We're doing it today in Scientology. Why are we doing it? It's just because we're working with this item, this somethingness that cares. And when we look this over, we discover there's a sort of gradient scale of being there, a gradient scale of presence, a gradient scale of caring, a gradient scale of being able to participate in this game called life. And we find, oddly enough, that when the livingness goes, there is nothing but deadness. And the livingness is goodness. And when it starts to depart, it leaves nothing but the impulse, whatever it is, an impulse which cannot differentiate between good and evil. It leaves a clock. And sometimes we have people who almost aren't alive. They're still ticking over. It's simply because something didn't care enough. And isn't caring enough to go on playing with the doll. This is an interestingly fantastic fact. As this somethingness that wants it to live is more and more convinced by collisions and conflicts with the environment that nothing and nobody wants it there, it starts to depart on a sort of a gradient scale. It's taking less and less participation. It cares less and less what's happening. It's less and less willing to work, to do good, to help. Less and less willing to live, to heal the body. And that thing is the person. It does a nice trick. It says, I am the person, and I know only what the person knows. And in this way, I can bear to live and play with this doll. It's a fantastic thing. Very interesting thing. An interesting mechanism. It's fabulous to work with this mechanism. To work with the actual beingness of man. To work cheek by jowl with the greatest mystery there is and see that it isn't a mystery at all. But it's a very simple thing. But all great truths are simple truths. People talk for thousands of years about the human soul and then tried to use this talk to control it. All you have to do is just look at it and understand it a little bit, and things begin to happen. Fabulous things. Now, what's left behind if this living unit... Let's be much simpler about this. Let's not strain anybody's credulity about talks of ghosts and ghouls and things that go boom in the night and thetans or anything else. But let's just talk much more factually now. And let's talk about it this way. That the individual cares less whether he lives or dies. And when he cares less, he therefore behaves less in participation in the society and in the game of the family, in the game of birth. He cares less what happens to it. He cares less what's going on. So he kind of halfway withdraws. He isn't quite there, we say colloquially. He isn't quite present. Well, what's he left behind? His livingness is being done on a stimulus response mechanism. When emotion comes in there, he rigs the body so emotion corresponding to that will go out there. And this, former researchers have made the mistake of believing, was the totality of life. It is simply a stimulus response mechanism. It works in that fashion, and you can actually do a stimulus response ectomy. Fantastic thing that you can actually sort of delete this from the body and still have a body go on functioning and living. This stimulus response mechanism gives the standard response for the standard stimuli. And we get a sort of an adding machine or computer. And when somebody says boo to this fellow, why, he's supposed to say back boo, or he's supposed to say back cats, or he's supposed to say back textbook. See? Somebody is supposed to be trained in engineering in this wise. Somebody comes in and says the square root of minus 3... over the square root of 16 equals the stress strain of bridge girders. Is that right? And it's supposed to go into the machine this way and go over this way and whir out this way. And the fellow says, yes. Because man can build an electronic brain that way. The electronic brain boys and I get along fine. Except we have one point of horrible argument. I'm always pointing out to them that although this brain will answer all kinds of questions, it has this slight liability. It can't feed itself the questions to answer. And I keep pointing out to them, you are standing there feeding the questions to it. And they say, oh, no, I'm not. Well, this thing is autonomous. And I'll say, all right, now let's get some astronomical data out of this electronic brain. They say, all right, and they write it down on a slip of paper, and they start to feed it into the machine. And they say, yes, you see, the thing figures out astronomy. See how good this is? And you say, look, I ask whether or not it could answer electronic questions on the subject of astronomy, and you wrote it down on the punch tape, and it was fed to the machine by a living being. And its answers are being read by you and me, and that machine is incapable of appreciating us. You say, no, you've got the wrong idea. The machine thinks. It does everything necessary to think. And if you figured out right, a bank of these machines could ask each other questions, and you'd have a society. Nah. Every once in a while, somebody comes along and writes all well that ends well, you know, and pours it into the society. People say timidly in engineering, he was just a machine. No, he wasn't. Because the society dies unless somebody feeds it a question once in a while if it insists on running automatically. Well, anyway, the machine starts running, and the man stops living to the degree that he doesn't want to live and that he doesn't care. Fascinating thing. Horrible to contemplate. He becomes more and more a clock, more and more an electronic brain or a clock, the less and less that the livingness itself works along with the machine. And when he's totally alive, when the individual really does care, as in a moment of emergency, such as we've seen a few of in our lifetimes, the whole guy is there. He's there, all of him. He's interested all the way. And he does everything that he's doing without any recourse to machinery. House burns up. There's a grand piano in the living room. A couple of the kids grab it and put it out in the front lawn. Fire's put out. 5 men from the moving company put it back. Did you ever hear things like this? A totality of presence brings about almost a totality of action. And it doesn't depend on machinery because machinery can't run that fast. An examination of the stimulus response mechanism shows that it has too slow a reaction time. It has, interestingly, long communication lags when one is running on that machine. And a being, all air, doesn't have any. Bang. Now, what's the end product of all this? It means that a stimulus response mechanism would have no responsibility for the state of its fellow man, would it? That electronic brain doesn't care who feeds it what. Has no idea who feeds it what. It simply goes round and round and gives out the answers. Gives them to anybody. Somebody can come along and put a big sign on it. Says, security, you will not give any more answers to Russians when they walk in and feed them to you. Russian walks in, it answers. Somebody comes in and says, machine, you shouldn't have done that. Shouldn't have done that. Pow! Machine doesn't run. Somebody says, well, it was a traitor. Now, that's what would happen
if you had a total stimulus response mechanism, you'd have something without any choice, without any criteria. No idea of right or wrong, no idea of good or evil, no idea of caring whether it lived or not lived. And you'd have a machine, all right. And that machine would be very adequate. It would do good or evil as life interpreted it, and no more. It would have no morals, no ethics, nothing. One could train some morals into it. One could train some ethics into it. The funny part of it is that the more moral we try to make man, the less moral he gets. Not so the machine. It has no power of choice. Man has. And we can say, well, he's just a higher order of machine. But the funny part of it is when we work with him as just a higher order of machine, we don't get tremendous IQ rises. The degree to which an individual is withdrawn from the society or driven away from the game is the degree to which he will do evil. And we get a bright child that wants to play with the doll. And we drive the child away from playing with the doll. And then the child starts to break the doll. And then we drive the child a little bit further away from breaking the doll. And the child, after a while, messes half-heartedly with the doll. And if given any opportunity at all, the child would simply wind up the doll and let it run from there on and sit back bored in the corner, not caring for any consequence about what happened to the doll, what didn't happen to the doll. You see that this could happen? Well, the beingness and livingness of man not only can do, but does do just this. The degree to which he is driven out of the game is the degree to which he and his societies die. And when we have a whole society that's no longer willing to work, that society can be good or evil any way you want to look at it. When we have a whole society where the people in it have been forbidden to contribute to its existence and continuance, we have a society that doesn't function very well. Now we have to have a dealer, a fellow to sit up there and hand out the questions to all of these computing machines. Somebody's got to run this thing. It's less and less self-determined. It's less and less successful. That society will win which has in itself the most self-determinism. And that society will lose which has in itself the least. So we could say that as an individual grows older and older in a society which isn't functioning very well, he would be driven further and further from his actual abilities, from caring, from participating. He can get back to a point where he doesn't care really whether he lives or he dies. And when he gets back to that point, then he does good or evil. It doesn't matter. He's just running an electronic brain. He as an individual is no less alive, no less dead, but he as an individual just doesn't care. He doesn't even care whether he knows about it or not. And so we can get an automatic society if we've driven out of it the willingness to work, the willingness to participate, and the willingness to play a game. A society is actually, whichever way you want to look at it, good or evil, and reflects and mirrors any master that is good or evil to the degree that no one is playing the game. And all we have to do is get this livingness, this beingness, to look a little harder, care a little more, be willing to participate a little further. He gets brighter. He gets better. He gets more capable. Not only that, but his motives get better and better and better and better. How could his motives get otherwise, since his motives himself natively are very good motives? It's only the machine motives that are bad. So the more he participates with the game, the better the game gets. Delete from a society its willingness to participate and its willingness to work, and you've killed a society. That's all you have to do. There aren't even dead bodies lying around. They're animated. They've got chains on their ankles. They're working. Oh, are they? Also, they don't care. The only riches which one has amongst the working people is the willingness to work. And when one's killed that, he's killed all there is. So therefore, one actually can't make people worse than they are? The person just backs off into status quo, cares that much less, and the whole thing goes on automatic. And there it sits, running. It's a clock. It doesn't care what happens to you. It doesn't care what happens to me or to itself. People have driven off just this much, because if you drive them off any further than that, they simply die. You could take shock, pain, duress, the whip, punishment, fear, and all it does, this goodness and beingness of man that actually is his livingness and beingness, is himself, is you, sitting right where you are, on some gradient of caring or being willing to live. And we can drive it back off so the man cares less, and the whole thing goes on automatic and becomes a machine. And then we have a great machine society that doesn't care whether it lives or dies. It simply goes on with its cogwheels running, without morals, without ethics, without goals or ambition. And such a society then, as a totality, dies. All we've got to do in working with somebody is just show him that it's safe, that it's decent, that it's good, and it's worthwhile to participate in this game. And his abilities rise, right straight up to the zenith. We haven't put anything new there. We have just said, look, you too can play this game. The individual says, well, a lot of people have been telling me I haven't been able to play this game. They've been telling me I couldn't play this game. They've been telling me that was the one thing I mustn't do is play this game. And you say, well, so they were wrong. Come on, play the game. The fellow says, well, all right. Okay, maybe I can. And all of a sudden he's brighter, better, more able. And he finds out, mysteriously enough, that regardless of what he thought, regardless of what he was educated to believe, 9 times out of 10, when you do this, he discovers that there wasn't any game in progress. It wasn't really bad or good. As he comes in to participate, he finds in any society running on automatic that he has to originate a new game, not by revolution, but by injecting new thinkingness, new beingness, new livingness, new loyalty into the game. And only in that way can he make a game that he's willing to play. And that's where we're going in Scientology. Thank you.